From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. This morning, House Republican leaders called the president's State of the Union address a tremendous speech that set the right tone. A House Democrat said the best thing about the speech is that it's over.
It was a speech filled with talk of comedy, but also direct confrontation. This moment stood out when Trump, praising the women's employment rate, inspired that huge contingent of newly elected female Democrats wearing white in honor of the women's suffrage movement to leap to their feet, pointing to themselves, newly hired. Trump was taken aback, but had a good recovery.
Don't sit yet. You're going to like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
And at that, chants of USA, USA broke out on both sides of the aisle. But that was one of the rare moments of unity. Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And Bill Press, the Democratic radio host. Hi, Bill.
Hello, hello. Good to be back.
And Alice, I want to tee one up for you. The president referred to caravans of immigrants attacking the border. NPR is reporting that most are traveling legally on humanitarian visas through Mexico. Towns on the border are considered some of the safest in the country. The mayor of McAllen, Texas, said send social workers to process asylum seekers, not soldiers. The president also made the same reference to stopping investigations as Richard Nixon did in his State of the Union before he resigned. Not a good look. But today, are you one of the many Republicans applauding?
I am. Robin, I think it was a solid speech. I do think for his base, he hit all the right notes. He outlined yet again his case for securing the border and building his wall, also talking about taking steps to prevent late-term abortions. That was important, and check that box for his base, and outlining what his successes with regard to certainly the economy and federal government regulations, what he's done with regard to national security, unemployment rate at an all-time low. So from a Republican standpoint and those on his base, it was a good, solid speech, and also inspiring with the stories he used and how he weaved that into his speech. I do think it was a solid A for the president.
Bill, I'm guessing you have a different grade.
I kind of think the gods – yes, you're right. I kind of think the gods are angry. You know, Sunday we had the worst Super Bowl probably ever in history, and Tuesday night not because of who won, but because of the game. And last night I think we had the worst State of the Union ever in history. But I got to tell you, I've been covering politics and States of the Union since Ronald Reagan, and ever since that time – I've made the point every year that the State of the Union, which is supposed to be a solid report to the nation, has devolved under Democrats and Republicans into just an opportunity for the president to hold a big rally for the members of his party and not serve its original purpose. I think last night was basically a MAGA rally.
Well, and it comes not long after the longest government shutdown in American history and right before the deadline for a possible new shutdown next Friday if they don't reach a deal. Alice, it didn't really seem like he made any, you know, moves to try to make a deal in that speech last night. He went right back to digging in.
Well, Jeremy, if you notice, he didn't really say the word shutdown last night.
No.
And I think that was clearly by choice and by design. And he made the case yet again for how we have a crisis at the border. I personally don't agree there is a crisis, but I do think we do have a problem. But he made the case on why members of Congress need to take action. It's important, as he did, reminding Democrats that they have supported a fence before, the Secure Fence Act of 2006, and they were fine with it then, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be fine with it now. So he laid the groundwork for planting the seed in those House and Senate members' minds that they've got some work to do in the next week and a half.
Yeah, if I may, I thought it was stunning, if not appalling, that he did not mention the word shutdown. The fact is, he spoke last night and not a week before, because he couldn't speak a week before because it was a government shutdown. We are in a bare 3-week minimum, maybe 10 days away now from another shutdown. There were people in the audience who had worked for 35 days without getting a paycheck. And I think the reason he did not mention the shutdown is because if he had, the Republicans and the Democrats would have sat there in silence. Nobody in that chamber wants another shutdown.
Let me ask you. You just mentioned, Bill, what's the use of this speech? And Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, mm-hmm. the Missouri Democrat, said he wasn't sure Washington needs a State of the Union. Historian Julian Zelizer tells us, hey, it may be broken, but we have to hear from our leader, unlike other countries. But, Alice, what do we do about truth? I mean, you just said, yeah, you don't believe there's a crisis on the border, but it's a problem. But there is a huge difference between saying something's a crisis and ginning people up and saying it's a problem. There is a difference. You mentioned, late-term abortions and the president saying how, people want to, kill babies, late-term babies. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact language he used. But that's not the language that people used in recent discussions. They talked about fetuses that were not viable. There's a difference between a fetus that's not viable and somebody deciding to kill a late-term baby. Doesn't this matter?
It does matter, but this comes during a time when it's important that he send the message to his base that we all need to defend the dignity of every person. And specifically what he did mention, I actually have the speech here, he talked about the governor of Virginia where he, as the president said, he basically stated he would execute a baby after birth.
And unviable. No. I'm sorry, Alice. He used the word unviable. The governor did.
I'm just reading what the president said last night.
That's what I'm saying. How do we know that we had a person yell out liar at a past president? Bill, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I understand the president wanted to gin up his base, but that is not an excuse for the president of the United States telling lie after lie after lie. The Washington Post this morning, I'm sure the Boston Globe, the New York Times this morning, did a lot of fact-checking. And it's on basic things. Like the president said, he has gotten rid of more regulations than anybody ever in history. Not true. Ronald Reagan did. Jimmy Carter did. You go down the list. He said that El Paso was once the most dangerous city on the planet, and now it's the safest. Not true. Crime has gone down, and El Paso has nothing to do with the wall, the mayor said today. So you cannot use I need to help get my base behind me as an excuse for lying. It's just unacceptable.
To button up the issue on life, his overall message that he was trying to deliver, which is one he did throughout the campaign and has as president, is to work together to build a culture that cherishes innocent life. And protecting the sanctity of life is something he has stood for, campaigned on, and a lot of folks
that
do
does
support.
Not excuse a lie, okay. Alice. I'm sorry. Does not excuse a lie.
I just want to – we could talk about the State of the Union all day, but there is some really important and interesting news coming out of Virginia today that I want to ask you both about. So we've talked about the scandal involving the governor, Ralph Northam. Then there are accusations against the lieutenant governor, who would replace the governor if the governor were to resign, sexual assault allegations from 15 years ago. Then now today there is word that the attorney general, Mark Herring, also a Democrat, third in line for the governor, admitted to wearing blackface at a college party in 1980. He apologized in a lengthy statement. Now, none of them has resigned. However, if all of them were to, the next person in line is a Republican, the Speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates. Alice, it's like House of Cards. It's like a House of Cards story.
I can't imagine where we're going to be by the end of the week, one after the other after the other. And look, this kind of behavior that we've seen exhibited is just not acceptable, and it should not be tolerated. It should not have ever happened back in that time and certainly now. It's inexcusable and insulting. I will say this with regard to Mark Herring, the latest revelations.
General.
Right. I feel like if you're going to have the situation happen, he has handled it correctly. He has apologized. He's been very clear that it was a mistake and it shouldn't have happened, and said that he accepts full responsibility for his conduct. Right. If this is going to happen, this is the way to handle it. Governor Northam handled this terribly. So I am anxious to see, unfortunately, if there's another shoe to drop. But this is just a sad day. And Bill, as a resident of Virginia, yeah. It's not good.
Bill, I'm sorry. We've got a minute. I just wanted to do one thing here because we had a response to the State of the Union, and it was you can characterize it any way you want, but it was not in response to the State of the Union. In the minute we have, you've been talking and seem pretty worked up about the truth and honesty of a State of the Union. Why not then? Why can't the responding party in this year, it's the Democrats, be brave enough to actually do a quick turnaround and respond to the things that were said?
I think that would be an excellent idea, given the opportunity. And I would, let's right here and now, call on NPR and then all the networks to give the Democrats an hour and a half tonight to have whomever they want to respond and go through one by one.
Why couldn't they have done it right then? They had the speech.
Well,
they had the transcript
have.
In advance.
They didn't have they were not given the time. They're given 10 minutes. I thought Stacey Abrams did an excellent job last night. But that idea to respond to the State of the Union is probably the worst job in the world because you have to do it ahead of time. You can't really respond.
Right.
I think the lack of a proper response is a shame on all the media.
But she got no negative press for it, so good for her. Bill Press and Alice Stewart, thanks to both of you.
One of the nominees for this year's Best Documentary Oscar had me and audiences sweating buckets, watching through our fingers, even though we knew the ending. It's National Geographic's Free Solo, which follows climber Alex Honnold as he becomes the first person to climb Yosemite National Park's 3,000-foot rock mountain El Capitan, with no ropes to catch him if he falls. Filmmakers Jimmy Chin and his wife Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli filmed Alex with a team of cameraman climbers on ropes, all aware that one little mistake from them would kill Alex as he clings to the tiniest indentations, at one point debating whether to swing one leg out to get a toehold on a ledge or jump sideways.
In some ways, it makes more sense to do the big two-handed jump because you're jumping to a good edge, so there's actually something to catch. But the idea of jumping without a rope seems completely outrageous. If you miss it, that's that.
That's that. And Alex Honnold is in the NPR West Studios in Culver City. Welcome and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
On both living and getting the nomination. And filmmaker Jimmy Chin, welcome to you as well. And congratulations to you and your wife.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And Jimmy, I want to start with you because, as we see, while Alex is training for this climb, this is a film that we're discussing. The climb, of course, first and foremost. But you filmed it. And you and your wife were very conflicted about that. Explain why.
Well, I think the main question for us was whether or not us being there filming him would make it more dangerous or more likely for him to fall.
Yeah. I used to work a lot with cameras, and you said you were conscious of something called Kodak courage, people who will do something because the camera's there they wouldn't maybe ordinarily do.
Yes. That was one of the central questions that Chai and I had to answer for ourselves, was whether or not we trusted Alex's decision-making process and how he would approach the climb and whether or not the external pressure of a production would push him to do something that he wouldn't normally do.
Or whether I see you've said somewhere, even, dropping a lens cap.
Yes. Being that the climbing is very tenuous, I mean, if you knocked off a pebble even, it could actually fall 200 feet and hit him just at the wrong moment. There were a lot of different scenarios that we thought about and tried to kind of imagine all the different outcomes in order to mitigate the risks.
Yeah. I think it's maybe worth adding that overall the production probably made it slightly safer for me just because, we're talking about Kodak courage. In a lot of ways, I experienced the opposite because I was up there with my friends working on it so long. Because there were people watching me, I wound up preparing more for the climb than I'd maybe expected.
Because on your end, Alex, you didn't want to put them in the position. This is so hard to even say. You'd be dying right in front of them.
Yeah, I certainly was trying to avoid that. But but even more so, I was just trying to do my due diligence to some extent. The crew was putting so much effort into crafting a great film. And so I was trying to do my share. I was trying to make sure that I put in the amount of effort as well.
Yeah. And just to back to that thought, not that I want to belabor it, but, too late. I probably already have. But Jimmy, as you said, you would see him go through the frame.
Yes. Mm. I think over the course of 2 years of production, I think I woke up every morning thinking about the worst case scenario. That sounds really morbid, but I mean, it also is a useful tool to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Truly didn't think about it every day. I mean, because I certainly thought about worst case scenarios as well, but not every day. I mean, it has to be a balance of best case scenarios.
It was weird. It was every day when I woke up in the morning. I had like this.
Well, no wonder it all seems
pressure.
So stressful for you.
Alex, now do you feel bad?
Yeah, now I feel bad for sure.
Well, let's talk about what we're talking about. We've set the stakes here. But Alex, free soloing, seeming to pull yourself up. Your upper body strength is amazing. Your fingers are amazingly strong. What's the appeal?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that because I think what's often lost is the joy of it. You know, the sheer joy in the movement and how almost playful it can be to climb a wall of that size and scale unencumbered. I mean, it does feel quite beautiful. And I think that at the heart, I've always loved the movement of climbing. And free soloing is, in some ways, the purest way that you can rock climb.
Yeah.
And so I spend a lot of time talking about the consequences, facing death, those kinds of things. And those are natural questions. But I think actually the joy of it is why I free solo.
Because it's not like you're not looking, you're seeing where you are. This context of, you're in the air. There are points on the mountain when it's just friction, there's some kind of friction between maybe a toe and the wall or a thumb and the wall. What does that feel like?
I mean, it feels incredible. I think you were just kind of touching on it. I mean, to be surrounded by air, to be in the void but still feel in control personally, to take a situation that should be terrifying but then to feel comfortable, through preparation, through hard work, through, I guess, self-mastery to some extent. I mean, it feels incredible.
We learn a lot in the film about how you in particular may be more able to do this than the average bear because you have a special brain apparently where, you do, where it's been tested and your amygdala doesn't really fire the way other brains do. That's the kind of the...
But I actually don't think that that's a unique feature. I think that's the result of 10 years of exposure in this space. I mean, basically by having spent so much time free soloing, putting myself into these positions, I think I've sort of desensitized my amygdala to certain types of stimulus.
And let's explain, because it doesn't fire up. So you're saying I had the chicken and the egg wrong. You're saying
exactly.
It's a result of...
Exactly.
So it doesn't fire up the way ours might when we get frightened or we're thinking we're not going to survive. Yours has toned down.
Exactly. I think that the level of stimulus in the test that I underwent is just not sufficient after having spent my whole life free soloing on big walls. And it's hard to say what comes first, chicken or egg. I mean, maybe that's why I've loved free soloing so much my whole life, is maybe, I am slightly duller in that response than average.
Is that, I'm wondering, this idea that you're not frightened.
Well, no. So on the actual day of the climb, I wasn't particularly frightened. I was still certainly nervous walking up to the base because it's still a pretty intimidating wall. It's very, very large.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I was very frightened for the many years ahead of time. And that's why I put so much preparation into it. That's why it was something that I dreamt about for so long and didn't actually do. And it wasn't until I spent 2 years working on it that it actually became a possibility.
Well, this is something that really impacted a lot of the people that I was with who are athletes in different ways. Every single inch of that climb, you had planned ahead and done over and over and over again on ropes.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's what I felt like I needed to feel comfortable up there.
Yeah. Jimmy Chin, talk about the planning that you had to do.
There was a tremendous amount of planning and choreography in terms of shooting Alex on the wall. And, over the course of 2 years while he's practicing, we're essentially also practicing how we're going to shoot it. So logistically, there is a lot of matters that we had to deal with. It's a 3,000-foot wall. There's certain sections that are 1,000 feet down the wall, and you need to get a camera person 1,000 feet down the wall.
Mm.
They're carrying all their camera equipment. They're building their cameras on the wall. It's a pretty significant physical task. We also wanted to make sure that on the day of the climb, there weren't a whole lot of decisions to be made. So we practiced shooting and figured out exactly how we wanted to shoot each section that was, important to the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the producing, I think that the real challenge was kind of insulating Alex from the pressures of the production.
I want to talk about one other aspect of the film. Jimmy, your wife, Elizabeth Chai, not a climber, she was interested in the effect, Alex, that your climb had on a new girlfriend. So your relationship with her becomes a thread in this film. And there's a moment where she asks you if you would ever take her into consideration when approaching a climb. Let's listen.
Would putting me into the equation actually ever change anything? Would you actually make decisions differently?
If I had some kind of obligation to maximize my lifespan, then, like, yeah, obviously I'd have to give up soloing.
Was me asking you, do you see that as an obligation now?
No. No.
Oh.
Oh.
Yes, Sonny's not going to be thrilled that that's the clip, but I mean, we had many conversations like that. I mean, it's hard to, we're still dating, and it's, we're 3 years into this great relationship, but, we were in this new relationship, and free soloing El Cap is something that I'd been dreaming about for so many years that it just meant so much more to me than, a new girlfriend's opinion, but clearly that balance changes over time.
Right. Alex, El Capitan, behind you, are you done?
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. No, I mean, I'm certainly not done climbing. I'll climb my whole life. I love climbing.
But I mean, that kind of climbing, not just free solo, but the impossible.
I don't know. Honestly, El Cap has just meant so much to me for so long. You know, it was worth it. We'll see if anything else ever captures the imagination for me in quite the same way.
Yeah. And again, Jimmy Chin, I'm just wondering, part of the film I love is when one of the cameramen, who I have such an affection for you, Alex, they all do, he turns around. He can't look through his viewfinder. He can't see a particularly difficult passage. He can't watch.
Yes.
And Jimmy Chin, I'm wondering, how about you? Were there parts where you just could not watch?
There weren't, because the directive I gave to the entire team, and which I felt like I need to live up to, was that you needed to stay focused on the task at hand. That was for the wall team. It was okay for Mikey to turn away because he was filming on the ground.
Yeah, and in some ways, I mean, Mikey had to watch the entire 4 hours of the ascent, whereas the crew on the wall, I would climb past him for a few minutes at a time.
Yeah.
But Mikey watched the whole thing, which is why he was horrified by the end.
Yeah, he couldn't handle it. He
was a wreck. But by the way, that reminds me, I did want more. Will we ever see that four-hour climb?
I hope so. That's what I want to see.
People have asked about it. Maybe someday. Maybe someday.
Jimmy Chin, one of the filmmakers of the Oscar-nominated Free Solo, made it with his wife, Elizabeth Chai Vesarelli, and an unbelievable camera crew, Alex Honnold, the first person to free solo climb El Capitan in Yosemite's National Park. Best to you both. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Our pleasure.
And the IMAX version is in theaters now. Alex says it put him on the mountain, but I'd caution it's not for the faint-hearted.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
There is new evidence that President Trump's America First rhetoric is having an effect on tourism to the United States. Overseas visits grew just 2% in 2018, according to new data from Tourism Economics. That at a time when global tourism overall was up 6%. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, editor of Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tourism growth has slowed, and this trend started 2 years ago after President Trump took office. Put that in context. How much was it growing prior to that?
Well, earlier this decade, more like 4%. This is obviously a mature market, not a place where you're going to get very high growth, but the authors of this study say it's slowed down. And even last year, they say they're concerned that in the second half of the year, it was slower than in the first half. So not a good trend.
Is it fair to blame it on President Trump's America First rhetoric?
Well, look, that's probably unhelpful, but this is the hard part, is trying to answer that question. The dollar is also strong, mm-hmm. and a strong dollar makes it more expensive for people from overseas to visit the U.S. So, the authors say, look, tourism from Germany in particular, a place hit by trade tensions, down a lot. China, down a lot. You know, whether that's because of the rhetoric or also because of the strong dollar, almost certainly, at least partly because of the strong dollar, hard to say which is the biggest. The biggest factor here.
But what's the effect? How important is international tourism to the U.S. economy?
It's very important. Tourism is an export. And I know that might sound a little bit confusing because you think, well, people are coming here. Are we importing? But it's something that we sell. And when it comes to exports, it's our biggest service export. Now, overall, as a percentage of all exports, kind of high single-digit percentages. So yeah, it's important, and it's generally a growth industry.
And do you expect, looking at the numbers now, this slow international tourism growth to continue into this year?
It's difficult to be too optimistic right now because, you know, trade tensions or no trade tensions, again, those currency issues, a strong dollar. I mean, you look back decades, and whenever it's expensive to visit the U.S. and you know, in some countries, we could be talking Canada or we could be talking a place like Brazil where it's far more expensive now than it was. That's going to put downward pressure. A place like Japan, which used to not get a lot of visitors, the yen has been weaker in recent years. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Tourism is booming there.
Well, when we were in London in the fall, it was very cheap comparatively because the pound is down and the dollar is up. I want to ask you about one more thing, Seth, which is Southwest Airlines completed a test flight yesterday from Hawaii, from Oakland, California to Hawaii. This is the first time. I mean, Southwest doesn't fly to Hawaii yet. Now it's starting to do that. They're waiting for FAA authorization to start scheduling flights. This is a big step for Southwest.
It is. And yesterday's flight, just kind of checking off another box on the way to getting there to where, you know, these planes will be full of passengers. Yesterday, you know, mostly empty flight of FAA inspectors. And
some lucky FAA inspectors.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So that Boeing 737 MAX, you know, this new kind of plane that they have that can fly a really long way. So just for now, just kind of showing that they can do this. They've got the navigation down and all that sort of thing. And then, at some point here, if all goes well, they'll have flights on sale that all of us can buy and go visit Hawaii.
Probably bring down the price for flights to Hawaii on all the airlines if Southwest starts competing in that market. Seth Kaplan.
Supply and demand economics, yeah.
Exactly. Editor of Airline Weekly, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Last night in his State of the Union address, President Trump expressed support for Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido, who declared himself interim president last month. Trump's comments probably got the attention of the nearly 250,000 Venezuelans who have fled to the U.S. in the past 5 years as Venezuela's economy has collapsed. Most of them live in South Florida. And for many of those Venezuelans in exile, the growing opposition to President Nicolas Maduro gives them new hope. Tim Padgett from member station WLRN in Miami reports.
On Saturday, Venezuelans in South Florida woke up to this.
Desconozco la autoridad irrita y dictatorial de Nicolás Maduro y reconozco al diputado Juan Guaidó como presidente encargado de la República Bolivariana de Venezuela.
It was a video of Venezuelan Air Force General Francisco Yanes renouncing Venezuelan President Nicolás Maduro. His defection marked a crack in the military's loyalty to Maduro, the authoritarian leader widely condemned for trashing Venezuela's economy and democracy. Yanes called on other officers to recognize National Assembly leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate president, as the U.S. and many other countries have. And that raised hopes that the socialist Maduro may finally be forced from power. Which is why Venezuelan expats were feeling unusually festive Saturday evening as they gathered at a plaza in Doral, just west of Miami, for a pro-democracy rally. The event coincided with big anti-Maduro marches in Caracas and across Venezuela.
Bienvenidos. Gracias por estar aquí y decir presente.
Belén Marrero was one of the Doral organizers. She was born in Venezuela and was a popular telenovela actress there until the socialist regime
cut my career because I was opposed to the government and they closed the door. I couldn't make any role on TV.
In 2014, Marrero joined the more than 3 million Venezuelans who've left their country in recent years. She became an opposition activist here in memory of her father, a Cuban exile who died without seeing his country freed from communism. She doesn't want that same fate for herself.
We are celebrating the resurrection of our forces to fight to our freedom. Nobody believes in our fight. Because no, they are like a Cuba. No, they lost the country. No, my father was Cuban. I have the memory of his history. I have on my heart all the time the strength to still fight.
I've been living in the United States for 20 years, and this is the first time that I really, really think we are on the brink of big change.
Robert Barani owns Perinola, a Venezuelan restaurant here in Doral. He left Venezuela when Hugo Chavez and his socialist revolution came to power in 1999. He says he could see dictatorial abuses on the horizon, and he admits he'd begun to fear his homeland was lost.
We were a very big family in Venezuela, and seeing all the family losing their home, all of my families around the world, My daughter has never been in Venezuela. It's a very sad thing.
But now that the U.S. and much of the international community have declared Maduro's re-election constitutionally illegitimate, Barani feels buoyant.
I think they know it could take time, but it's going to be the break that we needed.
I went to Venezuela this December.
Luis Gomez was wearing a Venezuelan flag as a cape.
And the people, the faces, the feeling, you know, everyone was sad, was gray, no hope. Now this has changed the whole ballgame. Right now my dad is in Venezuela, and he says that the people over there are hopeful again.
Gomez's dad hasn't abandoned Venezuela. He still goes there to check out his cheese company. Gomez is now 25, and he says he looks forward to living there again to help run the firm, especially since opposition leader Juan Guaido, only 35 himself, promises to bring younger, fresher leadership to the forefront.
Guaido has been doing things in a different manner. And yeah, I would love to go back. When I'm there, I'm happy. You know, I'm in my zone of comfort with my people.
And I haven't seen my parents since I came here, 7 years ago.
Seleni Jurado is a paralegal in Miami Lakes. She, too, is 25. Her elderly parents sent her here to study, but they missed her so much they joined marches in Caracas recently, hoping to bring down Maduro. One day, they were almost killed by soldiers' gunshots.
It's hard. I always told them not to go, but they said that if they didn't do it, nobody was going to do it for me. It's hard.
But like most of the expats in Doral on Saturday, she was heartened when Guaido appeared on a large screen above the plaza addressing them personally.
Muy bien. Adelante. Vamos, Venezuela.
Saludos, Doral, Guaido said. Be ready for democracy to return to power in Venezuela, even if it takes time, maybe months, if ever, to make that happen. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Yes. Here we are, the 76th Oscars, and he's still gold. His hip is titanium, but he's still gold.
So they went and gave me a live microphone for 3 hours. There haven't been this many showbiz executives sweating over one woman since Heidi Fleiss, honey.
I think most people dream of winning an Academy Award. I had a dream of actually hosting the Academy Awards. Let that be a lesson to you kids out there. Aim lower.
Well, don't expect another moment like that at this year's Oscars, because ABC Entertainment President Kerry Burke confirmed yesterday that this year's ceremony will go on without a host. So what does this mean for the biggest night in Hollywood? Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So we know that the reason that there's no hosts was that Kevin Hart was originally tapped to be this year's host, but he stepped down when he was called out for homophobic tweets and jokes that he made several years ago. But why can't they find somebody else?
It's quickly emerging that these kinds of jobs are the most thankless jobs in Hollywood. you're in a situation where you do become a target. I do think that a lot of comics are worried that people will go back in their history and look at old tweets and do the same thing to them that happened to Kevin Hart. And it's already a tough job. You have to command this room that's filled with some of the biggest stars on the planet. You have to be funny in the room and funny on television. And you also have to manage this huge show that almost always runs over time and almost always is difficult to keep people interested and engaged in through the whole length of the broadcast. So I'm not surprised that a lot of comics looked at that and said, you know what, I don't really need the exposure, and it's too big a risk to my standing. I'll pass this time. And from what I understand, even Jimmy Kimmel, he wasn't originally asked to do it again because they realized that, you know, it's a tough position to put somebody in, because whoever comes in next would also be seen as sort of undercutting Kevin Hart.
I have to say, though, that to me, it's sad that we've gotten to the point where people are so afraid that somebody's going to go and look back through their old tweets or whatever, or they're going to criticize them, that they're not even willing to put themselves out there and do that the way that Jimmy Kimmel did and others.
I absolutely agree, and I absolutely feel that the reason things went down the way they did with Kevin Hart is because he handled the situation terribly when it first emerged. You know, people were aware that he'd said all these homophobic things years ago. He never really fully apologized, and the question was always open about, did he feel that being gay was terrible back then, and does he still feel that way today? You know, first he refused to apologize, and then when he apologized, he stepped down from hosting the Oscars. And I just don't think he handled it well. And I think that's a lesson for all of these kind of controversies. If you just step up, admit what you did wrong, and fully sort of be transparent about what happened, I think you can get past it. But, you know, people's egos get in the way. Right. And it resulted in this controversy that made no one want to host the Oscars.
So what's the Oscars going to look like without a host?
I think we're in a situation where essentially the presenters will host the Oscars. Now, there's some question about, like, what will the opening number look like? You know, how will some things be organized that normally a host sort of helps move along? But essentially, they'll just have this succession of stars come out and do little comedy bits and cheeky asides and introduce everything. And I think the folks at ABC were hoping that it'll actually make the show run faster because you won't have to make room for a host to come in and give a lengthy monologue and give that host space to talk while the show is going on. Maybe things might move a little faster. So we'll see if that works out.
That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
All right. Thanks for having me.
How about that scorching heat and deadly flash floods in Australia? Extreme weather, just the opposite from the recent frigid cold in the U.S. In Australia, January saw the worst heat in the country's history, with temperatures over 120 degrees in parts of the west. So hot that flying foxes, these are bats, falling dead from trees because, and this is terrible, they are frying. The country's Bureau of Meteorology had to create new colors on the weather map to show how hot it's been. And this month has also seen unprecedented flooding. People in Townsville being warned to watch out for crocodiles and snakes spotted in residential areas. Oh, and there are wildfires. Here's a weather forecast on Sky News today.
This trough of low pressure has been sitting over the southeast every single day this week, and it's triggering daily showers and thunderstorms, and we're stuck with a dry easterly airstream along the west coast, which is why Perth is seeing temperatures well above 30 every single day this week. Let's start in northern Queensland.
That's 30 Celsius, well above, and that's something like 86 Fahrenheit and above, which has become the mean temperature in Australia. Amanda Lynch is professor of Earth, Environment, and Planetary Science at Brown University in Rhode Island. She is Australian, though, and joins us now. And Professor, your thoughts, you know, those not familiar with Australia, put this in context.
Well, it's certainly a hot and dry continent, but what we're seeing right now is just a rapid uptick in the extremes. And what's really unusual is that those extremes are not associated with things like El Nino, which is normally the cause of extremes, particularly in eastern Australia.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because we had the extreme cold in the Midwest, and it was attributed to the polar vortex. And it was said that a lot of the weather patterns here in the U.S. in the last few weeks had to do with hot Moroccan air that was trapped up at the pole and was forcing this polar vortex down. And it was being attributed to, you know, the extremes that are attributed to climate change. Is what's happening in Australia the same, but just the opposite?
The dynamics of the system are quite different because of the arrangement of the continents in the southern hemisphere. So that changes things somewhat. The other thing to remember is that Australia is much closer to the equator than the US is. So you need to think about this in terms of the whole country being more like the southern part of the United States. Mm. In that context, the problem that Australia is having is not so much that changing polar vortex is hitting Australia and giving it extremes. The problem that Australia is having is that the polar vortex is missing it altogether. Mm. The rain and moisture that comes with that is not hitting Australia. And as it gets drier, the heat ratchets up.
And as you're watching this, we mentioned the flying foxes. And, you know, we've been hearing about plant life. Obviously, humans are affected by the heat, but they have air conditioning. What are you thinking about as you see these extremes?
The concerns that I have for Australia's long-term future, and by long-term, I mean even just in the next few decades, there are a lot of changes that are happening very rapidly in ways that the natural systems and the human systems can't respond to quickly enough. Some of the first climate change related species extinctions have happened in Australia. We're seeing critical diebacks in the Great Barrier Reef.
When you say that there's extinction, you know, people are talking about insects, plant life, and of course, in the circle of life, you take one piece out and everything gets affected. Are you hearing stories about those kinds of concerns?
The primary concerns that I'm hearing about from my colleagues in Australia are the species that call the Alpine territories or the southern parts of Australia, particularly in Tasmania. Those species are unable to move anywhere to get away from the heat. You can't go higher up the mountain when you run out of mountain. You can't go further south where it's cooler if you run out of land. There is a type of wallaby, a mountain wallaby, that is facing some difficulties. The problem with calling an extinction, it's a really fraught thing to do because the science part of our heads is saying, you know, you have to be able to absolutely prove there isn't a single living creature out there. And then, of course, the emotional part of it is, have we lost that animal forever? Calling an individual extinction is something that's really fraught in the ecology literature.
Well, it certainly is true that plant and animal life, if not completely extinct, are dying because of this extreme weather. And what are you hearing from people back home? How are they keeping cool? How concerned are they about what's going on? We've been so focused on the cold that it's so interesting to be reminded about the heat.
My sense is there's a fair amount of frustration in the lack of action over near-term adaptation and also long-term mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions. I think that people are certainly making the link between the fires, the floods and the heat and the climate policies of the government.
We are the frog in the slowly boiling water. Amanda Lynch,
right.
Professor of Earth, Environment and Planetary Science at Brown University. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ron.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.